Bienvenue à tous. Alors je vais parler en anglais, même si je crois que Adam comprend bien le français pour avoir passé certains temps en France. It's my great pleasure and honor today to welcome for the last session of our seminar on practical knowledge, Dr. Adam Carter, who is currently research assistant at the University of Edinburgh. After holding several prestigious positions as visiting lecturer at the University of Eindhoven, University of Geneva in particular. Adam is a very, very accomplished scholar in epistemology, philosophy of mind, philosophy of language. He wrote his PhD on the value of knowledge and the problem of epistemic luck under the supervision of Professor Duncan Pritchard, with whom he has written a considerable number of very important papers. Not only has Adam already written about 40 major papers on such topics, just to quote a few of his last ones, Knowledge, How and Epistemic Value with Duncan Pritchard, Extended Emotion with Emma Gordon and Epistemic Internalism, Content Externalism and the Subjective Objective Justification Distinction, Epistemic Situationism, Epistemic Dependence, and the Epistemology of Education, with Duncan Pritchard. Intellectual Humility, Knowledge, How, and Disagreement, with Pritchard again. Extended Cognition and Prepositional Memory, with Kallerstrup. Active Externalism and Epistemic Internalism, Varieties of Cognitive Achievement, Group Peer Disagreement, as just impossible to quote all his extremely important papers, so I suggest you take a look at his very impressive web page. But he's currently editing or co-editing various volumes also, in particular Knowledge First with Emma Gordon, The Moral Psychology of Pride, again with Emma Gordon, and Extended Epistemology with Clark, Kallerstrup, Palermos, and Pritchard. Oxford University Press, Socially Extended Knowledge, Intellectual Humility, and also two monographs, Meta-Epistemology and Relativism, which I think has just finished.
It's almost finished. I'm on the last chapter.
Yes. Yeah. The last chapter. And a critical introduction to Knowledge How. So Adam is indeed one of the most deeply involved and much most talented young men in the various issues we've been discussing so far on the current debates surrounding know-how, practical knowledge. So I think I thank him very much for coming from Edinburgh to let us know how he views the non-linguistic arguments for intellectualism. Thank you very much, Adam.
Thank you very much, Claudine. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for inviting me and for that very generous introduction. So I'm going to be critical in this talk about intellectualism, about Knowledge How. And this turns out to be a topic that I find to be a lot of fun to think about. One of the focuses of this talk is going to be to consider certain counterexamples and whether or not they work. And these counterexamples frame some of the recent work that I find most interesting about Knowledge How. So first, just to put the view on the table, intellectualism about Knowledge How maintains that what grounds one's knowing how to do something is always at least in part one's propositional attitudes vis-a-vis the thing in question. So on this picture, when you know how to ride a bike, for instance, this will be in virtue at least in part of certain propositional attitudes you have. For instance, you might know that for some way W is the way for you to ride a bike. So there's two components to the anti-intellectualist view. One's a negative component, which is just to deny that claim, to say that that's false. It's not the case that knowing how to do something is always, at least in part, in virtue of having certain propositional attitudes. But anti-intellectualists in the contemporary landscape aren't just pessimists and say this isn't true. They also have their own story. And what they claim is that when you know how to do something, it's always, at least in part, in virtue of some ability that you possess. So I have to make a kind of careful distinction right off the bat, because there's a distinction that easily gets blended with the distinction between intellectualism and anti-intellectualism, which in fact actually can come apart from that distinction. So most people who are intellectualists, who think that knowing how to do something is in virtue of, for instance, knowing propositions, also have a specific view that they take on a separate question from what it is that grounds knowing how to do something, which is what is the metaphysical nature of knowledge how? And here, intellectualists typically opt for a view that we can call propositionalism, which is the thesis that knowing how to do something is essentially a propositional attitude relation. That's just what it is. And the reason I mention this is because there is a new version of intellectualism on the scene that embraces intellectualism by answering the grounds question as they do, by saying that it's propositional attitudes in virtue of which that ground knowledge how, while Bengtsson and Moffat, these are the authors that do this in recent work, they deny that the metaphysical nature of knowing how to do something is to be understood as a propositional attitude relation. Rather, they characterize it as an objectual attitude relation, which is a relationship between an agent and a way of fying. So I say that just to say that I'm not going to be talking about Bengtsson and Moffat's idiosyncratic but very interesting version of knowledge how in this talk. I'm going to focus on the view that most folks have in mind in the contemporary debate, which is embraced by Stanley and Williamson, which says knowing how to do something is in virtue of knowing facts, in virtue of our propositional attitudes, and that's just what it is. It just is. So this is the view that we can call it reductive intellectualism. Knowing how to do something just is a type of propositional knowledge. So here's a taxonomy of a range of, let's just call these pro-intellectualist strategies that are defended in the recent literature. One kind of strategy is entirely defensive. So those familiar with Ryle will know that Ryle thinks that intellectualism, at least as what he calls the intellectualist legend, the idea that skilled action is always guided by acts of the mind, is subject to these regress arguments that, according to some contemporary exponents of anti-intellectualism, sink more modern versions of intellectualism as well. So that's one way you can be pro-intellectualist. You can say that these regress arguments that are construed as problems with intellectualism can be set aside or not ultimately problematic. I'll call that a defensive strategy, because it's not really showing why the view is true, it's showing why the view doesn't succumb to these regresses. So by far the most popular way that intellectualism has been defended in recent work is originally by a breakthrough paper by Stanley and Williamson in 2001. And more recently in work by Jason Stanley, his book Know-How, published in 2011, has been very influential in this respect. Also, there's papers by Brogard, which make this kind of a move. The argument is that intellectualism is true on the basis of, by and large, linguistic and semantic considerations. Here's a rough but fair enough, I think, characterization of the move that Stanley and Williamson and Stanley make to say that intellectualism is true. Call this the linguistic strategy. The idea is to say that in virtue of various linguistic, syntactic, semantic considerations, the following is true. Knowledge WH, knowledge where, knowledge who, knowledge what, reduces to knowledge that. And further, the next leg in this view is that knowledge how is a species of knowledge WH. And so knowledge how reduces to knowledge that. That's the most popular line on the market for intellectualism. And some would even go so far as to say that the argument, the main argument for intellectualism is the linguistic argument, which takes this broad strategy. So in some of my recent papers with Duncan Pritchard, we have attempted to argue against this linguistic strategy by taking kind of the same general tack in all three of our papers we've done together. And the tack goes like this. If these folks arguing for the intellectualism via the linguistic strategy are correct, then knowledge how is just a kind of knowledge that. Now, Stanley says in his book that if knowledge how just is a kind of knowledge that, as the intellectualist wants to say, the reductive intellectualist, then the properties of knowledge how should be the same as the properties of knowledge that, and that includes in, what Duncan and I draw attention to, which is epistemic properties. So in recent work, here's what we've tried to do. We've tried to argue against linguistic strategies for intellectualism by saying that here's one epistemic property we say that knowledge how has, which knowledge that lacks. So we say that knowledge how is compatible with a certain variety of epistemic luck, environmental epistemic luck, which is incompatible with knowledge that. If that's right, then we've claimed certain properties that Knowledge How has that are epistemic in nature, which Knowledge That lacks. Therefore, our move is to say these two things come apart, they're not the same thing, contra-reductive intellectualism. We've also, in recent work, tried to make the same strategy of move to say that Knowledge How involves cognitive achievement, essentially, Knowledge That does not. And the latest paper says that Knowledge How is, just to put the conclusion bluntly, is more epistemically valuable than Knowledge That. So all of these are arguments that I've found interesting and tried to pursue lately, which takes issue with the linguistic strategy for intellectualism by saying that if the conclusion is true, this is an absurd or an unpalatable consequence. Today, that's not what I want to do. Rather, I want to turn to a more neglected style of argument for intellectualism and engage with that. So I've kind of cobbled together a bit of two kinds of views, which I'm going to call non-linguistic strategies for intellectualism. So these are not the kind that are pursued by Stanley and Williamson and others. And what I want to do today is I want to engage carefully with these strategies to see if they're any good. These are less discussed strategies. Non-linguistic arguments for intellectualism are going to take two main kinds. The first kind I'm going to talk about the most, the second type I'll talk about at the end. The first type is what we can call negative non-linguistic strategies for intellectualism. Negative non-linguistic strategies for intellectualism are, these are the work of Bengtsson and Moffat in their 2011 book, and in the introduction of that book, and also in a paper that they included in their volume. What they do is they say, basically this is a rough characterization, they say we can either be intellectualists or anti-intellectualists. Anti-intellectualism is completely unworkable. Therefore, literally what they argue is that the necessity and sufficiency claims put forward by anti-intellectualists are not workable. And so therefore, this makes intellectualism look like the only view left on the table. So that's one way that you could support intellectualism, by painting the opponent as being fundamentally intractable. So that's negative non-linguistic strategies for intellectualism. I'm going to consider some of these in some depth. And the second kind of non-linguistic argument I want to consider is a positive non-linguistic argument. Typically, anti-intellectualists in contemporary epistemology and philosophy of mind often draw from considerations to do with cognitive science, for instance, distinctions between declarative and procedural knowledge, and argue on the basis of this claim distinction that Knowledge How comes apart from Knowledge That. Stanley does a pretty interesting thing in a recent paper with a neuroscientist, John Krakauer. He tries to turn the table by appealing to cognitive scientific evidence. He says that not only does cognitive scientific evidence not show that intellectualism is false, but in fact, it can be, we can advert to this exact kind of evidence to show that intellectualism is true. So this is a non-linguistic positive strategy for intellectualism. That's the second kind of view I want to talk about. But first, let's look at Bengtsson and Moffat's negative strategy, which is really interesting. In fact, I think, although I'm going to criticize Bengtsson and Moffat, I think that they're two of the most capable writers on intellectualism and anti-intellectualism and Knowledge How more generally writing today. They make very careful distinctions, they're very good, and I think their counterexamples are really interesting, so I think they're worth going through carefully and giving them due credit. I'm an anti-intellectualist, so I'm not persuaded by their counterexamples, but I think that their counterexamples are to be reckoned with, so I'm going to try to give these counterexamples a fair shake and show what I think is ultimately uncompelling about them. So their strategy against anti-intellectualism is by counterexample in both directions. And of course, if their combined argument is right, then obviously the thesis that one knows how to fi in virtue of possessing the ability to fi is off the table, leaving the intellectualism looking like the viable alternative. So the first move is they argue against the necessity leg of anti-intellectualism. This can be characterized as follows. One knows how to fi only if one has or has had the ability to fi. So if you're an anti-intellectualist, you've got to accept this. And indeed, this is surely what Ryle, the arch anti-intellectualist himself, had in mind when he diagnosed a Lewis Carroll-style case in his 1945 paper. Roughly, the idea is you can imagine a pupil and a teacher. The teacher tells the pupil how to draw an inference. The pupil says, okay, I know this, yes, thank you for all these facts, and then the pupil nonetheless fails to be able to draw the inference. And one diagnosis of this case that Ryle considers is that, well, this is to show that knowing how to draw the inference, the skilled action that consists in knowing how to draw the inference, is something that one can't secure just in virtue of gaining more propositions that are true about how to draw an inference. Rather, what it is in virtue of which one knows how to draw an inference when one does is possessing the ability to do something. And that's what, according to Ryle's diagnosis of the Carroll case, the student lacked. So clearly notice that Ryle has something like the necessity thesis in mind when he's talking about this case. And indeed, right, to the extent that anti-intellectualists are committed to the core insight that when one knows how to phi, it's going to be in virtue of possessing the relevant phi abilities, an endorsement of AIN, the necessity leg, looks unavoidable. So here's a counterexample that they give. Now this smiling fella is an actual ski instructor. They have a ski instructor that they call Pat in the case. And you'll immediately see the import of the case. Here's how it's supposed to go. And again, this is Bengtson and Moffat's attempt to argue against AIN. So Pat has been a ski instructor for 20 years, teaching people how to do complex ski stunts. He is in high demand as an instructor since he is considered to be the best at what he does. Although an accomplished skier, he has a history of skiing. He has never been able to do these particular stunts himself. Nonetheless, over the years, he has taught many people how to do them very well. And in fact, a number of his students have won medals in international competitions and competed in the Olympic Games. This is their example. So immediately you can sense, without even thinking very hard, how a case like this could potentially pose problems for an anti-intellectualist who thinks that possessing an ability to do something is necessary for knowing how to do it. Namely, because Pat, our ski coach, knows how to do the jumps, as we would say. He knows how to do the stunts. He teaches the gold medal winners. This is how their thinking goes. Yet he doesn't possess the ability to do this himself. So that's the rough contour of the case. Let me just, does anybody find that compelling? One has to admit, I'm an anti-intellectualist. I found this to be a case that definitely requires a response. Now, Bengtson and Moffat anticipate a response to the case. And then they argue that that anticipated response is no good. However, I think that their anticipated response can't be dismissed as easily as Bengtson and Moffat think it can. So here's a way that they envision someone attempting to get rid of this counterexample by saying that it's not genuine against the thesis. It isn't a genuine counterexample. So imagine this reply on behalf of the anti-intellectualist. Well, this ski instructor case is a case where an individual merely knows how one does something, namely the stunts in question. In this case, Pat knows how one does the stunts, but knowing how one does the stunts is not the same as and does not entail knowing how to do that thing in question. I think this is a pretty good response. They anticipate this. Now, so as the envisioned reply to the counterexample goes, ski instructor is a case, and this is what they imagine the anti-intellectual saying, ski instructor is a case where one merely knows how one phis while lacking the ability to phi, but a genuine counterexample to AIN must be one where the agent both lacks the ability to phi and knows how to phi. Thus, since knowing how one phis does not entail knowing how to phi, ski instructor isn't a counterexample to AIN. So I'm going to name, because I'm going to be referring to this envisioned strategy of reply to the counterexample, I'm going to be referring to it, let's just name it and call it the one phis reply. That's the best that I could think of. So is that reply any good? The counterexample is pretty good, but also that reply is pretty good. Well, here are some further reasons to think that this reply is pretty decent. It can be paired with a pretty simple pragmatic explanation for why it might nonetheless seem, in certain contexts, felicitous to attribute to Pat knowledge how to do the tricks, right? Even if we're perfectly happy to say that Pat knows how to do all those stunts, when the intended implicature is that Pat, as opposed to perhaps others in the conversational context, can teach the stunts, it would nonetheless, right, be natural to retract this claim where, in context where teaching is not salient at all, where no one cares if anyone can teach them, rather we care if they can in fact be done. For instance, a context where competitors for the ski jump are ski jumping team are being chosen. Now compare this with the observation that in most any context, it seems appropriate to say that Pat knows how one does the stunts. Enough to maintain that Pat doesn't know how to do the stunts, even if there are contexts in which it's felicitous to say that he does. So this strategy fits nicely with other observations about how we might retract certain attributions of knowing how to do something as opposed to knowing how one does something. However, Bingson and Moffat have a clever counter reply, so a reply to this reply. And it's clever, but basically what I want to say is this counter reply to the reply is a knife that cuts both ways, and it can't support their view any more than it can count against it. That's the broad brushstroke strategy. I'm going to explain this now. So here's why Bengtson and Moffat think that the anti-intellectualist can't advert to that reply that I just considered, the one fives reply, in an effort to dispel the force of the ski instructor counterexample. It goes like this. Their counter-reply says, let's grant that knowing how one fies does not entail knowing how to fie, but insist that despite the intuition relied on in the anticipated one fies reply, insist that Pat actually does know how to do the stunts after all, and so doesn't merely know how one does them. Now, here's their trick, and this, again, characteristic of Bingson Moffat is a clever one. They say, suppose we now, and here's why we can now, again, like think that Pat maybe does know how to do the stunts. Compare Pat with Albert. And suppose that, again, Pat is a ski instructor who has, in fact, he does ski. He just can't do those particular stunts. Suppose that Albert is a scientist who doesn't ski, but knows how Albert does. Albert knows how one does the stunts by knowing how the muscles contract in particular ways when one does a jump. Now, the suggested line of thinking here is that we should draw three conclusions from the comparison of Pat's situation with Albert, the scientist. And this is what Bingson and Moffat are inviting us to think. Number one, both Pat and Albert know how one does the stunts. Neither is able to do the stunts by stipulation. Only Pat, but not Albert, knows how to do the stunts. There's something to that, right? So that's okay. So I mean, if that's compelling, then the one fies reply can't diffuse the counterexample. Now I want to diagnose what I think is going on here, and then raise an objection to what Bingson and Moffat are up to here with this comparison between Pat and Albert to elicit the response that they want. So the diagnosis of the key insight behind the comparison with Albert, the scientist, is that intuitively knowing how to fly seems, right, in relation to knowing how to fly, I'm sorry, knowing how one flies seems in relation to knowing how to fly, by comparison more detached from the activity in question, right? And this is tracing out their thinking, and since Albert is not a skier, but Pat is a skier, Albert seems himself, right, comparatively more detached from the activity of doing the stunts than Pat, even though neither can do the stunts. So, and this is the intuition that I think they're relying on in the counter reply, so it would seem natural to pair Albert with knowing how one does the stunts and to pair Pat with knowing how to do the stunts. But now, so that's my thinking of why that is a seductive counter-reply to that reply. However, I think that we can just as easily run an argument by comparison that appeals to the very same kind of comparative insight to reach the opposite conclusion that Bingson and Moffat reached. So, does anyone follow skiing? So I don't so much. I'll go ahead and admit that. This is Camille. This is basically the best skier. He won 2 gold medals in the Sochi Games. I mean, he's as good as you get. The last name I was going to ask is, it has a CH in it. I can't remember his last name. But basically, he's as good as you get. So now, here's what I'm inviting you to consider. So rather than to compare, let's consider the comparison that they've made between Pat and Albert with Pat versus Camille. That was a typo there. So suppose Camille is able to do all of the jumps that Pat teaches with ease, And let's just, for added effect, let's just stipulate that Camel also knows the relevant physiology of the jumps. Given Pat's inability to actually do the jumps Camel is able to do, now here's my way to try to turn the knife in the other direction. It seems just as natural, I think, to say that Camel knows how to do the jumps, but Pat merely knows how one does the jumps, as it does to, when making the previous comparison that Bingson and Moffat made between Pat and Albert, the scientist, to say that Pat knows how to do the jumps, but Albert merely knows how one does the jumps. So that's my way to attempt to show that the intuition that they appeal to in raising this counter-reply would support the opposite conclusion just as well as it would support the conclusion they want. And if this is right, then what they have not done is successfully give us a reason to think that the one Fies reply can't diffuse that counterexample. Now, granted, the one Fies reply would potentially need some further defense. What I've suggested is it can't be knocked down as easily as they've attempted to with this comparison with the scientist, because one can draw a different comparison to elicit the opposite intuition. So the bigger picture here is ski instructor was supposed to, there was a lot of reply, counter-reply. Let's look at the bigger picture here. So ski instructor was supposed to be a counterexample to the necessity leg of anti-intellectualism. The one Fies reply provided a straightforward way to disarm this counterexample by explaining how Pat doesn't know how to do the jump. He merely knows how one does it. Bingson and Moffat attempted to dismiss this reply, and I've argued that their attempt to do so relies on a move that fails to successfully counter the one Fies reply. So my assessment is that cases like ski instructor are not ultimately compelling. They're not decisive against counterexamples against AIN. So that's the conclusion I want to draw with respect to the necessity leg. However, Bingson and Moffat are not done yet. They've got an argument against the sufficiency leg as well, and it's an interesting one. And I've probably thought more about this one. I've thought about them both about the same. This one's very tricky, and it's also a bit of fun. So according to anti-intellectualists, having the ability to phi is widely taken, right, not to be just necessary for knowing how to phi, but also sufficient for knowing how to do so. However, as Bingson and Moffat note, we have to be careful here. So it's obviously false that were, say, Tim to possess an unreliable ability to pick a lock, suppose that Tim's lock-picking success rate is 0.001. He has an ability, just like a really unreliable one. Imagine this. It would be ridiculous to say that he therefore counts as knowing how to pick a lock, and surely anti-intellectualists don't want to say that. It's not the case that possessing unreliable abilities to phi are regarded by the anti-intellectualists as sufficient for knowing how to do something. So accordingly, in following Bingson and Moffat, let's restrict the anti-intellectualist claim about the sufficiency of ability for know-how as follows. And this is a more charitable and plausible way to render the sufficiency leg of the thesis. So the idea is anti-intellectualism sufficiency, AIS. Being reliably able to phi is sufficient for knowing how to phi. So I mentioned that I had a YouTube clip, but it was complicated to get that up and running. So this is a PDF frozen image of what would have been some sal cows. If anyone watches Olympic figure skating, a sal cow is a move that can score a lot of points. It's a tricky move. And Bingson and Moffat advert to a case of a sal cow in order to argue against the sufficiency leg of anti-intellectualism. Here's the case. Irina, and this is a nod to the Russian figure skater Irina Slutskaya, Irina, who is a novice figure skater, decides to try a complex jump called the sal cow. When one performs a sal cow, one takes off from the back inside edge of one skate and lands on the back outside edge of the opposite skate after one or more rotations in the air. Irina, however, and this is tricky, so pay attention to the delicacy of what they've got going on in this bit. Irina, however, is seriously mistaken about how to perform a sal cow. She believes incorrectly that the way to perform a sal cow is to take off from the front outside edge of one skate, jump in the air, spin, and land on the front inside edge of the other skate. However, Irina has a severe neurological abnormality that makes her act in ways that differ dramatically from how she actually thinks that she is acting. So despite the fact that she is seriously mistaken about how to perform a sal cow, whenever she actually attempts to do a sal cow, in accordance with her misconceptions, The abnormality causes Irina to unknowingly perform the correct sequence of moves, and so she ends up successfully performing a salchow. Although what she is doing and what she thinks she's doing come apart, she fails to notice the mismatch. Now, Bengtsson and Moffat diagnose the case as follows. In this case, it is clear that Irina is reliably able to do the salchow. Let's quickly look again at the anti-intellectualist sufficiency thesis. They claim that being reliably able to phi is sufficient for knowing how to phi. B and M say, in this case, it's clear that Irina she's reliably able to do a salchow. However, because of her confusions regarding how to execute the move, she cannot be said to know how to do a salchow. Again, that's a somewhat seductive counterexample. It seems like you could make, well, I won't get ahead of myself. So there are two issues that are relevant to diagnosing whether this case constitutes a genuine or bona fide counterexample to the anti-intellectualist sufficiency leg. One, does Irina, given her confusion, fail to know how to do a salchow? And the confusion is a profound one, right? The second issue that is relevant to whether this counterexample is genuine is, does Irina have the reliable ability to do a salchow? So at least prima facie, it looks like, and this is conceding to the intuitive nature of Bengtsson and Moffat's case, they've also relied on this case, and I think a paper from 2007 as well. And they've discussed this case in a number of works. It looks like the answer to question one, does Irina, given her confusion, fail to know how to do a salchow, is, yeah, she does fail to know how to do it. This is me granting them the intuitive nature of the case. Yeah, it does look like she fails to know how to do it. She's deeply confused. Also, does Irina have the reliable ability to do a salchow? Looks like there's a case to be made that she does. Every time she tries to do one, she does it right. So, at least prima facie, it's clear that there's something going for the salchow case. However, I think that there are a number of lurking problems waiting in the wings. Let's look at some of these problems. And this is, the problems I'm going to consider now are from a paper that I've got under review right now with a co-author, Boleslav Czarnecki. He and I have a paper called Knowledge How and Salchows, and the whole paper is an examination of this case. I'm not going to go through the whole paper. I'm going to sketch a few of the contours that Boleslav and I put forward to suggest that this case isn't as persuasive as it initially appears. So let me begin by saying it's a familiar lesson in, I said early reliabilist literature later, but I guess this is mid-reliabilist literature, in early 90s, the brain lesion case, Alvin Plantinga's brain lesion case. Now I'll explain how this hooks up to the point about whether or not salchow is a good counterexample against a sufficiency leg in just a minute, but first just consider this case. Plantinga invites us to imagine that our hero, Al, has a strange brain lesion that reliably causes him to believe that he has a brain lesion. Although Al has no other items of evidence to support this conclusion. That's the Plantinga brain lesion case. Now, one of the lessons from this case is that it is really bad if you have a theory of knowledge according to which Al counts as knowing that he has a brain lesion. It seems like a bad result. And so essentially, if flat-footed reliabilism, according to which one knows, provided one's belief is formed in a reliable way, it looks as though the brain lesion case provides a problem or a reason to resist flat-footed reliabilism. This is at least how it was originally brought up in the literature. So it's bad, right, if on your view of what it is to know, have propositional knowledge, if Al counts as knowing. And that's widely taken to be the right way to think about the brain lesion case. However, there are multiple reasons that we might explain why propositional knowledge is lacking in the brain lesion case. Here's one explanation that I find to be pretty plausible. So a popular explanation for why Al doesn't know that he has a brain lesion, even though the brain lesion reliably forms him to form the belief that he does have this, proceeds as follows, and here's the explanation. Knowledge requires that a belief's correctness be in some suitably articulated sense attributable to the agent's exercise of cognitive ability. And secondly, and what is most relevant for our purposes, Al's believing the truth does not seem to be grounded in any ability to which we can credit Al. This is a point that's been hit home in a number of different works by John Greco. It doesn't seem as though any ability of Al's is such that we can credit to Al the correctness of his belief. Now, I want to compare this case now with another case that's familiar from the reliabilist literature, which is Lehrer's True Temp case. So in Lehrer's True Temp case, we imagine Mr. True Temp has, unbeknownst to him, a temperature-detecting device implanted into his head that regularly causes him to proclaim accurate beliefs about the ambient temperature. And I think we're supposed to imagine him just going, 82 degrees, 74 degrees. But he has no idea why he's saying this. It just happens to be that every time he is compelled to just shout the temperature, he's right. And that's thanks to the implant that he doesn't even know about. So True Temp is never wrong about the ambient temperature, but again, he can't tell you why. Now, again, just as with the brain lesion case, a lesson in the reliabilist literature is that it's bad news if, on your view, True Temp counts as knowing what the ambient temperature is, even though the implanted thermometer causes Temp to reliably form true beliefs on the matter. Now, again, there are multiple things that one might say when explaining what it is in virtue of which Temp fails to know. Here is one pretty attractive explanation, one that I think is pretty plausible. And again, this is following a Greco line. Again, at least one natural reaction will be to deny that Temp's correctness is down to any of Temp's own abilities. For much the same reason we're inclined to not credit Al's correctness about the brain lesion to some ability he has. So the idea is knowledge requires that the success be in some appropriate way attributable to an ability that you have. And in these cases, even though these agents have reliable processes that form beliefs, these reliable processes fall short of being abilities such that we can credit the correctness of the belief to that ability that the agent has. It seems rather what we're crediting to the correctness to is a production of a belief that is, or a cause that's external to the cognitive agency of the agent. Now, here's why I was talking about those cases. To the extent that we should resist following orthodoxy in the brain lesion and True Temp cases, the attribution of Al and True Temp's correctness to Al and True Temp's abilities, we have a precedent for denying an individual an ability to do something, even when she can reliably do the thing in question. So there is some precedent for making this move, denying that simply being reliably able to do something entails that one has the ability to do something, even if we often talk about people who can reliably do things as individuals who have abilities. There's some precedent for denying it in cases like this, and this is very similar in many respects to the Arena case. Now, specifically, if we want to, let's formulate the precedent that we can locate as follows. And this is a line that's been given expression by, along with Greco, Duncan Pritchard. Ernie Sosa holds this view, and Duncan Pritchard, note, takes this type of a view, even though he rejects the sort of robust or really strong type of virtue epistemology that Greco and Sosa endorse. So the line is this: it's appropriate to credit to an agent, and this is going to be relevant for what we say about Salchow. It's appropriate to credit to an agent an ability to perform a given intelligent action only if that ability is grounded in dispositions that are integrated in, and so, like in Alvin and Temp's cases, not disintegrated from the agent's cognitive psychology. So there's precedent for thinking this way. Now, Bengtson and Moffat, you can imagine, might already object at my tarring Arena with the same brush as Temp and the brain lesion case. But wait, in Lehrer's True Temp and planting his brain lesion case, the processes are strange and fleeting ones. Sort of like we imagine in the brain lesion case, oh no, the brain lesion arrives and then starts reliably causing Al to form correct beliefs that he has a brain lesion. Similarly, we imagine in the True Temp case, right, it just happens. It's a fleeting and strange process. However, as Bengtson and Moffat might reply, that's not the case with Irina. We can imagine that she's born with this neurological abnormality. And if that's the case, maybe there's a way to sort of cleave a wedge between the brain lesion and True Temp cases and Arena by saying that Arena is integrated, even though it's not the brain lesion and the thermometer aren't integrated in those other cases. However, I don't think that this reply would work even if we were to assume that Arena's condition were one that she had since birth and as such is not merely fleeting or temporary. One's ability is not appropriately integrated in one's cognitive psychology, or as Greco puts it, in one's cognitive character, unless there is a kind of coherence condition that's met. And John Quanvig puts this point well when articulating the coherence condition that needs to be met that's not met in the brain lesion and the TIMP cases, and which also is not met in the arena case of the sow cow. He says, what goes wrong is a matter of a lack of coherence between the understanding a person has of the reliability of various ways of forming and holding beliefs, he says about the brain lesion and TIMP cases, and how the beliefs are formed in those cases. And it looks like such a lack of coherence is also present in the arena case. We have reason to think that for reasons that broadly mirror the reasons that we want to deny crediting anything to Al and Timp's abilities, we have a similar precedent for thinking we shouldn't do that in the case of arena because the abnormality is not an integrated aspect of her cognitive psychology or cognitive character. So that's the line that I would take. Now, there's a more complicated way that we might think about this to be charitable to Bengtsson and Moffitt. I'm not going to have time, I don't think, to go through all of the details of this potential approach, but I'm going to quickly sketch what it is, sketch some of the contours of it. So let's try to be more charitable to Bengtsson and Moffitt and imagine that there are perhaps two different ways to read the arena case, the case of the sow cow, as a potential counterexample to the sufficiency leg. We can think of a, we can give the case a disintegrative reading and a dissociative reading. So on the disintegrative reading, here's how we're to think about the case. When the abnormality causes Irina to unknowingly perform the correct sequence of moves, it results in something like Irina compulsively performing a sow cow. So that's one reading. And this strikes my co-author Boleslav and I as a clear case of disintegration of one's cognitive character, precisely the kind of disintegration one finds with Al and Trutemp. And again, on this type of a reading, as I've suggested, I don't think that the counterexample is going to work. However, there might be a different way to think about the case. Call this the dissociative reading. So on the dissociative reading, what we could think of is Irina's abnormality is a peculiar instance of a mere dissociation of her doxastic failures from her manual successes, where those successes and failures are nevertheless appropriately integrated in some way into her cognitive character. And here's the key line on the dissociative reading. You could imagine a reading of the sow cow case according to which this is what's going on. The abnormality doesn't cause, as in on the disintegrative reading, where the abnormality forces you to compulsively perform a sow cow. Rather than that, we can imagine that the abnormality instead prevents Irina from ever forming a true meta-belief that her belief that some way W is a way to perform the sow cow is false, even though the abnormality has no direct impact whatsoever on her successful performance. I'm not saying that they had this reading in mind. Potentially, they could go with this reading. And it's possible, right? Maybe Bengtsson and Moffitt's case would be more successful along this type of a reading. Of course, they might suggest that, I'm going to have to skip a little bit about that. What I want to suggest is that this reading is ultimately not going to work for the reason that if we take this reading seriously, then it's going to be very difficult to save the idea that the sow cow case is a counterexample, because it's going to the more you opt for the dissociative reading, the more it's going to look like Irina knows how to do the sow cow. And here's a case that is meant to sort of show how this would be so. So this is a case of Chopin and Chopin's Star. I want you to think about this case and then see how, if Bengtsson and Moffitt opt for the dissociative reading, it looks like they're not going to get a counterexample, because then, right, you need it to be the case that Irina, for their counterexample to work, doesn't know how to do the thing in question, the sow cow. But on a dissociative reading, it's going to look like she does. So here's the, sorry, this the dialectic gets a little bit complicated here. Here's the Chopin case. So let Chopin's Star be just like Chopin, although Chopin's Star has a belief, which has no bearing on his performance of the piece, that some note in should be an A rather than an E. When performing the minute waltz, Chopin's Star does not attend to this belief, nor reflect on it, in any way. And nor is his performance in any respect guided by that false belief that he has. We think it would be at best controversial to attribute know-how to Chopin, but not to Chopin's star. And by parity of reasoning, it seems that it would be controversial to deny know-how to Arena on the dissociative reading, where her situation is going to end up structurally similar to Chopin's star. Where the false belief on the dissociative reading, again, the false belief has no impact on her performance. So that's an attempt to go a little bit further, travel further with Bengtson and Moffat. Well, that was, again, that I'm not claiming that they would opt for a dissociative reading. Rather, the thought was one might explore this interpretation rather than the disintegrative interpretation of the case that I think is more plausible. One could opt for a dissociative interpretation. Even if they do, then it doesn't look like it's going to be a counterexample. So on neither reading, so the thought goes, is Sal Cow a genuine counterexample to the sufficiency leg? Bengtson and Moffat have another case. They think the Sal Cow case works, but they also opt for a Kaitun-style case. Does anyone know what a Kaitun is? I guess you can maybe tell from the picture. It's a strange kite with a hot air balloon attached to it. Some people build these. I've never seen one or heard of one before I read this example. But suppose that Chris forms, for whatever reason, the desire to build a kaitun, a lighter-than-air kite that may, like a balloon, be filled with gas. She has never built a kite before. Again, this is supposed to be another case against sufficiency that's supposed to, I think, even be a stronger case by their lights. So she's never built a kite before, let alone a kaitun, but she's very good with her hands and thus is confident in her ability to make one. Seeking information about how to build a kaitun, information she currently lacks, Chris goes online and performs a Google search for building a kaitun. She finds a website with instructions. The instructions are long, but she is able to understand and follow each step with a modest amount of effort. Over the course of the next few days, she succeeds in executing the steps. The result of her efforts is her own personal kaitun, which she then proceeds to learn to fly. You can probably see where they're going to go with this one. So here's their diagnosis of the case. And the interesting aspect, they think, is the point at which she acquires that information and hasn't built it yet. So although the information Chris has at the time of her decision to build the kaitun is inadequate to build a kaitun, there is, and I quote them, there is a clear sense in which her situation, they say, is not hopeless. Quote, her current information state, and this is an important bit of what they say here, coupled with the information that she will encounter once she performs the Google search, will together be sufficient to reliably build the kaitun. So B&M's, Bengtson and Moffat's reason, they reason from this observation the conclusion that consequently, quote, Chris is, at the time of her decision, reliably able to build a kaitun, even though at the time of her initial decision, she does not know how to build a kaitun. You see what they're up to there, right? So I don't think that this case works. I think this, like the Arena case, is also a clever case. Here's the way that I am inclined to resist this case. You might have a different reason, or you might think that it works. So here's, I'm identifying, they don't say, here's a background assumption in their thinking. So their diagnosis of that case and why they think it's a counterexample to the sufficiency leg of anti-intellectualism relies on thinking that this, that an agent A can reliably phi at some time T, provided that the following two conditions hold. This is the general principle from which they seem to be making the diagnosis they make in Kaitun. So one, A's current information state at T coupled with information that at T A will encounter will be sufficient to reliably phi. That seems like the background assumption that they have in mind. Now, that background assumption is false, or so I'm going to now say. So here's here's my case to suggest that this background assumption is false. And if the background assumption is false, then their diagnosis of Kaitun is unprincipled or undermotivated. So here's the case. Wesley is supposed to recite, as part of his school production, a key paragraph from Winston Churchill's famous Iron Curtain speech. Wesley's present information, suppose at T1, includes the line from Stettin to the Baltic to Trieste to the Adriatic. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. An Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. Wesley, due to poor memory, can't remember the rest. However, at T1, given antecedent events and conditions in conjunction with laws of nature, Wesley will, at T2, acquire a piece of paper blowing in the wind, which contains the remainder of the speech. You see what I'm trying to do to Bing Sam Moffat with this. So because Wesley is such that at T1, his present information state, plus the information that he will, at T1, acquire, are sufficient for reliably reciting the Iron Curtain speech, the rationale that Bing Sam Moffat rely on in the Kaitun case imply that Wesley can reliably recite the Iron Curtain speech at T1, though I think that that's absurd. I think that it's the wrong verdict to say that Wesley can reliably recite the Iron Curtain speech at T1 prior to the rest of the speech blowing to him in the wind, even if we grant that it is going to blow to him in the wind. So Kaitun is a case where the protagonist at the time of the decision to make the Kaitun not only lacks the ability to do so, I suggest, but moreover, it seems implausible, or at least not clear, that Chris reliably can build a Kaitun at T, given the type of rationale that Bing Sam Moffat advert to. Now that concludes my case against negative non-linguistic strategies. I don't think that those strategies have been compelling. I think they've been interesting, but I don't think that they ultimately give us a reason to abandon either the thought that anti-intellectualism has a workable necessity leg or sufficiency leg. Now, I'm going to conclude by briefly looking at a positive non-linguistic strategy to defend intellectualism, which has been proposed by Stanley and the neuroscientist John Krakauer. This is an argument from cognitive science. Here's the case that is at issue. It's the HM case. This is a famous case. Has anyone heard of this case? Has anyone seen Memento? It's kind of like Memento. It's a case of anterograde amnesia. So HM was a patient with intractable epilepsy who underwent bilateral temporal lobotomy and was subsequently found to have persistent and pervasive anterograde amnesia. So HM is going to rapidly forget events soon after they occur. The psychologist Brenda Milner had HM perform a mirror drawing task in which HM had to trace the outline of a star with a pencil through a mirror with vision of his own arm obscured. Now, here are the results. HM showed improvement over 3 days on this task, even though on each day HM had no explicit memory for ever having encountered the task before, nor ever even having a feeling of familiarity with it. And this is as a result of the anterograde amnesia. But nonetheless, he got better. Now, of course, you might think, why are Stanley talking about this case? This case looks bad for the intellectualism. And indeed, the HM case has been, I think this has been adverted to by Charles Wallace and some other anti-intellectualists who appeal to cognitive, scientific, and neuroscientific evidence to support anti-intellectualism. I'm not sure who else appeals to this case, but this is a case that is normally used against the intellectualist. The HM case seems to show that one's motor learning can be retained even though one's knowledge about the activity in question is not. Unsurprisingly, right, the HM case is often taken to support a distinction between knowledge and skill that would appear prima facie unreconcilable with an intellectualist construal of knowledge how. Stanley and Krakauer interestingly think that suitable appreciation for the details of the case reveals that the case actually points in the other direction. So they write, and this is in the journal Frontiers of Human Neuroscience, an open access journal, They write, here is a fact about HM. Each time HM performed a task, this particular task, he received explicit verbal instruction and was able to use that knowledge each time. HM, of course, forgot that he used explicit knowledge, but he did. And that, of course, does not entail that he did not require, right, the knowledge at the time. So Stanley and Krakauer are suggesting that this case is, in fact, a case where the verbal cues were required and they were needed each time to do something, to do what he did. So just because you forget the knowledge that was required and in virtue of which you did the skilled thing, doesn't mean you didn't need that knowledge to do the skilled action. So they argue further that similar studies of patients with medial temporal lobe lesions like HMs, where the objective was to demonstrate that improvement in motor performance does not positively correlate with an ability to explicitly remember aspects of the task, it was also clear that the, quote, amnestic patients could not perform any of the tasks unless instruction was provided on each day. So they point to the fact that the requirement, the reliance on instruction wasn't idiosyncratic about HM, but also in a range of these cases that anti-intellectualists advert to try to make this type of a point. Now, Stanley and Krakauer grant that improvements in one's skill involve what they call motor acuity or practice-related reductions in movement variability that increases in movement smoothness, where such acuity needn't itself be propositional. But they turn the tables and say, but this just shows that manifesting skill involves both knowledge and acuity, and so does manifesting knowledge. More generally, Stanley and Krakauer take the HM case to be best explained by a proposal according to which, and this is, I believe, the title of their paper, motor skill depends on knowledge of facts. So, interesting. So they're attempting to take a type of evidence normally used against them and turn the tables. I don't think that this argument is successful. I guess I have just a few more minutes. Here's, in short, why. So, the relevant item of data, right, is that the amnestic patients could not perform any of the tasks unless instruction was provided on each day. Instruction, of course, which they'd forget later, but which they required. It is true that there's a sense in which the performance of the task depends on possessing the relevant propositional attitudes possessed when the explicit instructions were received. However, we can distinguish between two senses of dependence. One is a sense of metaphysical grounding. Often the term depends is used to pick out a metaphysical grounding relation. Ted Sider suggests that, for instance, for two facts, F1 and F2, we might say that F1 depends on F2 in a way that is meant to be equivalent to other grounding expressions such as F1 holds in virtue of F2, F1 is grounded in F2. But a completely different sense of dependence is captured by the idea that for F1 and F2, F1 depends on F2, only if, were F2 not to hold, F1 would not hold. In this respect, F1's holding depends on F2's holding in the sense that F2 is necessary for F1. Now, while the metaphysical grounding relation is thought to imply necessity, it's not the case that the opposite holds. So it's not the case that F2's being necessary for F1 entails that F1 holds in virtue of F2. Now, here's an example to illustrate this that Kit Fine, and I'm not an expert on this stuff. Some of this literature gets very complex. Here's a simple case that's used by Kit Fine to make this point. It is necessary that if the ball is red and round, then it is red. But the fact that the ball is red does not obtain in virtue of its being red and round. Now, the relevance of this point, this distinction of how dependence can be cashed out in terms of necessity or in terms of metaphysical grounding, and the relevance of that to Stanley and Krakauer's argument is this. Even if Stanley and Krakauer's observation that the patients could not perform any of the tasks, notice, unless instruction was provided on each day, could establish dependence in the sense of necessity, given that necessity doesn't entail metaphysical grounding, it's not the case that Stanley and Krakauer's observation entails the further point about metaphysical grounding. But since intellectualism is, and this is at least I'm following Bengtsson and Moffat in viewing intellectualism as a thesis about what grounds what it is we know how to do something in virtue of what, then the argument comes up short. Now, This is not to say that they could not appeal to the data to attempt to defend the stronger claim. Maybe they could. But in my qualified conclusion about this case is that simply pointing out that one thing cannot occur without the other thing is insufficient for establishing that that case positively suggests the intellectualist thesis that knowing how to do, in this case, skilled motor skill is something that is in virtue of knowledge of facts. I went through that a little bit quickly, but thank you very much for having me here. These are some references to some of the work that I've done so far on Knowledge How specifically, and some of the stuff that I've got in the pipeline about Knowledge How. And I'll be putting this stuff up on my website and putting drafts up there if anyone wants to see, including a draft of Knowledge How and SalCals, which I discuss some of that. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.